On today's episode, we're going to discuss the rules of the game. Welcome to the ultimate crowdsourced personal finance show. This is Choose FI.
You're listening to Choose FI Radio. The blueprint for financial independence lives here. If you're looking to unlock the secrets to financial independence and early retirement, you're in the right place. Stay tuned and join a community of like-minded people who are getting off the hamster wheel and taking control of their lives in the pursuit of financial independence. Choose FI, your home for financial independence online.
All right, guys, very excited to dive into this week's content. And to help me with this, I have my co-host Brad here with me today. How you doing, buddy?
Hey, Jonathan, I am doing quite well. Yeah, it's funny. Rules of the game, as you led off with, I was thinking about that in terms of just like little health hacks that I've been thinking about. You know, I'm kind of someone who just likes to learn a bunch of things about like a bunch of different areas of my life. As Tim Ferriss calls it, he's like a dilettante, basically. Like I like to kind of, you know, learn a little bit here and there. I'm kind of never go deep with the science or anything, but try to pick up like, what are the couple of little hacks that I can do to just make my life better? Kind of like an 80-20 analysis. So I was reminded of one of them this week, because actually, as you probably know, since you live 2 miles away from me, the overnight lows here in Richmond have been in the 40s this past week, which has been amazing. It's actually really nice to wake up in the morning and not be warm, right? To like walk outside, it's not 75 degrees. It's actually like 42 or 45.
What's amazing is that it actually gets back to 75 by 9 a.m. right now. That's a real,
isn't it, you know, crazy? Right. Like the intraday swing is like 30 some odd degrees. It's 35 degrees it was yesterday, which is insane. But, you know, in terms of sleeping, I think we've talked about it, and you say one of your absolute superpowers is sleeping. For me, not so much. That's kryptonite. Something I've always... Have you gotten worse or are you still
No,
there?
I'm just saying it's your kryptonite.
It is my kryptonite. And yeah, I mean, I try without being fanatical to figure out ways to kind of just help myself along, basically. And one of the people that I've leaned on is a doctor named Matthew Walker. He wrote a book called Why We Sleep. And I've heard him on a bunch of different podcasts. And one of the things he talks about is going to sleep in the cold and how it's really optimal for deep sleep, for optimizing REM sleep, et cetera. So like for me, I guess he said, and what I've heard him say different things on different podcasts, but on a NPR article I just read recently, he said 65 degrees at night is kind of like the optimal temperature for your house. We've actually found that it's like 63. I think that's generally what we leave it. And it sounds insane when you first hear it. It was funny because I was actually listening. A podcast that I like is it's called Animal Spirits. It's with Michael Badnick and Ben Carlson, and really, really great show. And they were talking about what do they set their thermostat to? And they're talking like somewhere between like 68, 69, even 71 is like where they generally leave it. And they thought like that was low. And I'm like, oh guys, come on.
What is low in July?
And that is low in July. Right. To be clear, we don't lower when it's 95 degrees out in, you know, mid-July. We don't keep our air conditioning at 63. But in the winter, yeah, we let the heat come on only when it gets to 63. And I found just very anecdotally, personally, but also like with some data on the Oura Ring, which I had a while back. And I found that my sleep was optimized when it was in that 63 degree temperature. So
does it measure movement?
It does measure movement. So it's not
like the Oura Ring. I know you mentioned the Oura Ring.
Yeah, that is the gold standard currently, but probably 10 years from now, we'll look back and say, oh, that's primitive technology. But I think, yeah, pretty much every doctor that I've heard says almost precisely something like that. This is the best we have now. It's not ideal, but yeah, it does in theory measure your REM and your deep sleep. And long story short, I have had more vivid dreams this past week
really?
When it got down to like 64, 65 in the house, just naturally, right? So like we're not putting the air on, obviously, but the house just naturally cools overnight as it's 40 some odd degrees outside. I have noticed just anecdotally, my sleep, it's been phenomenal. I wake up extraordinarily refreshed. And like I said, yeah, my dreams have been so vivid, like so unbelievably vivid. So
wow.
Yeah, Jonathan, I would say like for you, give that, I don't know what your temperature is at night, but give that a whirl.
I put a fan on, but probably we're also doing that while the house is somewhat climate controlled. And like, I had all these thoughts that I was going to ask you about, but they were all like on the edges until you said you got more vivid dreams by doing this. And let me just tell you, that is something that while I do sleep great, sleep like a baby, wake up refreshed, never have problems going to sleep. Like it's, you know, my superpower. I have been actually annoyed slash like kind of intrigued why I haven't had any sort of dream clarity or had any dreams in forever. And I remember as maybe a teenager or a kid having incredibly vivid dreams, sometimes good, sometimes bad, but you know, always would wake up with something that would then be, I would forget what it was by like noon or whatever, but I would wake up and I would hold on to it. And I've been trying to figure out why. Well, why is that? I'm a good sleeper. Why don't I dream? And to the point where I was even testing around like supplementing with melatonin, because melatonin is a supplement you can buy over the counter that's been, you know, shown to improve REM cycle. And I had just actually recently had a couple nights of somewhat remembering just a little bit of my dreams and thinking, huh, I wonder if like maybe I'm on the right path here. It was a really weird dream. I remember like working back at my first job at a fast food restaurant and I like destroyed some food or threw it at a customer for some reason. And then the owner decided to come to the restaurant at 3 a.m. and confront me. It was a very bizarre dream. But I had it my first dream, but I was like, do I want more of these? Yes, yes, I do. Not this one. Like to skip this one. And not the one where somehow I missed that one class in college. And because of that, you know, and I didn't take that one exam. Now I have to repeat that final senior year. I ever had that one before. I don't want that one either. But I want the other ones where, you know, where you're flying through Panama or something like that. I want those dreams. Give me those dreams back. Can deeper REM cycle get you there? So anyways, long story long, way of me telling you that that is very intriguing to me. And is your family, like everybody just happened to be on board with sleeping in an ice box and just getting more blank? Like what is the, you know, you have three other people that inhabit this house with you. Just everybody came to the same conclusion, or you had to sell the family on why the thermostat was underneath a lock and key?
Well, yeah. I mean, I guess the girls just kind of, they've never known anything differently. So my daughters, and
there's an anchoring principle we should just come back to there. Like that's actually something, but we'll keep going.
There is something there. And that's actually something that Laura does in terms of like buying them clothes and things like that. So yeah, there's something big there. But yeah, as far as Laura goes, I kind of showed her some of the podcasts that I listened to and had her listen to little snippets. It wasn't like a really hard sell. Usually when I have some idea that I feel pretty strongly about, she's willing to humor me at least, which is really extraordinarily lovely of her.
Most of my ideas like that only affect the family at the periphery as opposed to actively changing their environment. It's more like because I'm over here siloed, you have, it somehow just kind of affects you, but it's my silo and you're just, you know, on the fringes being affected by, you know, whatever that thing is, like juice fast or whatever. Like, well, you're not going to sit down and eat dinner with us. Well, I don't really want to stare at that steak while I'm sucking on cucumber juice. Like, you know, it's like that sort of thing. Whereas this is, let me drop your temperature by, you know, 10 degrees. Let's just try it.
But to be fair, and this is for everybody actually listening to this and not just me and you can do this without really impacting people, right? So if I turned off the heat at 6 p.m. and froze us out and then didn't raise the heat, if this was like a Phi cheapskate type thing, you know, I'm not going to turn the heat on until 9 a.m. and you're all going to be miserable, everybody would be miserable, right? And they'd all hate me. But this is just something where I start lowering the temperature, you know, maybe an hour before bedtime. So just shut the heat off. Or lower it down. You know, this is in the winter, right? Lower it down so that it's not coming on. It'll come on in the middle of the night if it gets to that temperature. And then in the morning, you know, in a perfect world, I have the thermostat set on a timer where it just starts raising. So when people wake up, they're waking up to a house that's been heating for the last hour, you know? So really for everybody else, it's minimal impact and it's only to the good because whether they know it or not, they're sleeping better. So like, that's kind of how I do this without impacting. But right, if you were doing it and like, hey, you guys have to suck it up and put on 7 sweaters and blankets because I'm too cheap to put on heat, totally different story.
Let's talk about the blankets real quick, because I think the point is actually that you are cold, right? Like it's like you're, as opposed to, and this is a real question. So I think I was like, okay, and all of us, probably a lot of us, like just not really thinking it through, would just say, okay, fine, I'll turn it down, I'll just get more blankets. But that would defeat the point. So are you just sleeping under a sheet and then everybody else can blanket up if they want to? Like for you, you're trying to be cold for 8 hours.
Yeah, in theory, and this is where like the limits of my like personal, obviously I'm not a sleep scientist, right? So just my own anecdote is, no, I'm not trying to shiver overnight. This is not like trying to lose weight or something by shivering, like nothing like that. I am under a normal amount of blankets. It's just that the outside temperature is cold.
So is it enough that just your head is cold? Because that's what you're kind of describing. Yeah. Like your actual core body temperature is probably, you know, where it would normally be. It's just now maybe your ears are cold. Does that give you the benefit? I mean, you're getting vivid dreams.
Yeah,
that's cool.
It seems to. Again, very anecdotally. But, I would say like as far as like rules of the game, just going back to that really quickly, is like the couple of things that I picked up that I think are really easy for people are, okay, cold in theory, dark as much as possible, right? So like we have blackout curtains. I've done like little things like any of those annoying little like red lights on like an alarm clock. Like I've unplugged all the alarm clocks, like, you know, the little red lights on the TV. Like I know this sounds a little nuts, but like I'll just stick a piece of tape over something, like, you know, just these little annoying lights that you see. And another one that I've picked up from Matthew Walker is like, in general, it's better to have kind of like a 90-minute sleep window. So like ideally, if your bedtime is, let's say, 10 or 10:30, let's say 10, just for ease, you ideally want it to be within a 90-minute period, let's say 9:30 to 11 or 9 to whatever, 10:30, something like that. So those are just kind of the very general rules. But again, I'm not dogmatic about any of this stuff. It's just, hey, can I remove the light as much as possible? Hey, can I sleep in the cold as much as possible? And then I try to adhere to that sleep window if possible, while not being fanatical, right? Like if we had, you know, a party to go out to, you know, or something, like I'm not going to go home because it's my sleep window, but 6+ nights a week, I'm going to try to stick to that if I possibly can. So
one more tiny question here, and then I'll add an additional thought on there. Like, have you ever, and because I just know the type of podcasts that you listen to, and I know these products exist out there, have you ever thought of or considered one of those cold sleep blankets?
You know, I haven't, but I feel like friends of ours have. I'm 99% certain Mr. 1500, Carl from 1500 Days, he's talked about either a blanket or a mattress, I think. Actually, I think it's the chili pad. It's something like that, which I believe is what you're talking about. And it's nice when you have, let's say you have a queen or king size bed. These things also have two different areas. So people who sleep at different temperatures can adust plus or minus a little bit.
Well, we're buying our mattresses from different places. But I mean, that was actually what made me think about, you know, the fact, like, are you wearing blankets? Because like, if you get a sleep blanket, that's a cold sleep blanket, it's going to make you cold, like your core temperature. And I was like, I don't know if I go to sleep like that. That was my thought. I just want to, you know, coming back to the idea of sleep hygiene just for a second here. Do you have a TV in your bedroom? Like just generally, as we're kind of wrapping this thought up, like your sleep is critical. It's so, so critical. Those of you that are doing all nighters, like you don't know what you're sacrificing on a regular basis. Think about that. A lot of times we think about a goal of a net worth. Like I think a very awesome, amazing goal is like never needing an alarm clock, or rarely. Like you don't need that giant blaring alarm clock. Like think about that. When you get to financial independence, it's one of the first things to go. Unless you're doing it as form of a morning routine, but you don't need to set it for a corporation's goals or a job's goals. You know, it is for you. Those LED lights, get that TV out of there, get those LED lights out of there. That's your sanctuary. You know, make your living room awesome, make your den awesome, have the man cave, whatever that thing may be. The bedroom is for sleep, you know, and other activities, but sleep, you know, that's just something to consider. Okay. Now, rules of the game. We got a little sidetracked because genuine source of interest here. And, clearly the point is when we're talking about rules, it's not for you to understand the rules of sleep. But thanks, Brad, for sharing. Let's talk about the rules of this game of life, maybe with a lens through financial independence. I was watching a Seinfeld episode, not in my bedroom, watching it downstairs. And, nice. You know, it's like you get to the end, maybe you circle back through Friends, maybe you watch a couple episodes of Cheers. Then you're like, you know what? I'm not as into that. So then you go back to Seinfeld and do it all, you know, something like that. Anyways, I'm back to Seinfeld. And Seinfeld's dropping this anecdote at the beginning. It's the lawyer episode. Elaine's having some issues. Anyways, at the beginning of this, Seinfeld drops an anecdote saying, you know, lawyers, if life is a game, lawyers are like the referees. They're like the ones that have actually read the rule book and then go, So that's the anecdote. And I was thinking as I was watching that, not wrong, but, you know, most of us, the majority of us on like a daily basis or weekly basis don't have to interact with lawyers unless we break the rules, unless we find ourselves on the other side of the line. And then, yes, you're absolutely right. But all of us need to know the rules of the tax code. In whatever country you're in, the tax code affects it affects the whole scenario. You know, if we think there's three aspects to this thing, if we're going to reach financial independence, we need to earn more from our baseline, whatever that is. If it's zero, we need to earn more. If we're earning something, we probably want to earn more. We're trying to optimize our expenses. Usually we have some control over that. We're controlling our expenses. Maybe we want to spend less, but you know, we want to spend whatever we do in the most tax optimized way. And then whatever happens there, however we're able to affect those two pieces, you move to the other side of the equation and it gives us, you know, some balance, a remainder, a gap, a difference. And there are ways to optimize that. If you are blind or ignorant of the tax code, it's going to cost you a lot of money. It is going to cost you a life-changing amount of money over your investing lifetime. And so the financial independence community has latched on to a few of these large ideas that can result in hundreds of thousands of dollars, millions of dollars over your investing lifetime. And we've built a playbook around it. And it's why we hold accountants in such high esteem, because theoretically, they're the ones that know the rules. Like if we could just get it out of them and have it tailored to our circumstances, they're the ones that have the rule book that we need. They can explain it. So as I was watching this anecdote, I was thinking, yeah, but you know, I would have swapped out lawyers for accountants in this case, just as it pertains to my life.
Yeah, that's interesting. So as the resident accountant here at Choosify, I will say thank you, obviously. But more importantly, I agree. I mean, I think that while I've talked many, many times on the show about how I did not exactly love my career as a CPA, I think that was more in terms of like the specific path that I chose, which was like corporate tax accounting and, you know, tax returns of like state income tax returns, which is as horrible as it sounds, as you can imagine. But I think what I really did appreciate was understanding accounting generally, right? Which accounting is, it's really the language of business. Jonathan, you and I have figured this out in terms of just running a small business. You need to understand like just the very simple, what does my income statement look like? How do I know, am I making money? How do you keep track of this? What do you do to document things? Like, again, the name of this episode is Rules of the Game. You just need to know, like, none of this stuff is that hard. It really isn't. It's just that most of us just don't know it, right? And once you understand, like, you know, now I have you trained if we have an expense or something, like, instead of just sticking it in your email and amidst thousands and thousands of emails, you just forward it to me, right? And I save it and it's saved for posterity. Just like little things like that. Or, I mean, we keep our financials in just a simple Excel document. But while it's simple and it's not that hard to do, it's that we've documented it. And I think this is what's so important for people listening is like, you never want to get to the point with anything in life, but especially with financial statements or tax returns and get to the end of the year, right? Like April 14th for your tax return from the prior year, and then have to go through and say, oh, what were all those charitable contributions I made? Or, oh, what the heck did we spend this past year in our business? Like, you're going to be in deep, deep trouble. But if you've done it right all along, then it'll be simple. It's really, really easy when, especially for most small businesses or a contractor, like a consultant, you're not going to have that many things on a given week or month. Just keep track of it, as opposed to 6, 8, 12 months down the road, having to scramble and figure it out. So like that to me is like the really high level kind of rules of the game, just about accounting, sure, but just life in general. I could probably come up with examples. I can't just off the top of my head here, Jonathan, but like, you know, it's always easier to do it right from the start, as opposed to having to scramble.
And to your point, you have trained me relatively well on this, and I'm not 100% here, but I do try. It is so much easier to do it as you go instead of trying to apply forensics to it, you know, the following year, right when it comes to tax season, and use whatever happens at tax season as a lesson, you know, for the following season. So I'd be curious from your accountant's brain, if we were to take a look at, you know, each leg of this equation, what you earn minus what you spend is equal to this difference or a gap. What comes to mind? I'll start with earn more here. On the earn more side of the equation, the tax code informs our decision-making process around finding out whether our employer has a match, finding out whether or not our employer has, you know, a 401k, a retirement offering. A match is free money. It's 100% raise on whatever that percentage that you're able to get is in many cases. The pre-tax is a massive benefit to those of you, you know, that are in a relatively high marginal tax bracket to allow you to defer those taxes till you have more control over your tax rate. We've talked about that, Brad, even in a recent episode.
Yeah, we talked about that in episode 346. And we can never reiterate this often enough, honestly. It's just like the marginal tax brackets. That's actually what came to mind the second you said like the earn more. Sure, there's the wonderful aspects of earning more. Like, hey, make sure, right? Like the 401k match, as you said, like that is part of your salary. All right. Most people don't think about it like this because it's not in that bottom line number. Oh, you make $80,000 a year. Well, okay, that's fine. But you actually really make more than that because let's say you get a 5% 401k match on an $80,000 salary, that's $4,000. So if you're not contributing to your 401k, you are not getting that match. And you're basically saying to your employer, you know what? I don't really want that $4,000. You keep it, right? Like who does that? So, I mean, that is part of your salary. You could also look at they're subsidizing your health insurance, right? Almost by definition, most employers are like the amount that you have to pay monthly. That's not what it's going to cost you if you had to go out and do it on your own. Jonathan, as you and I know from the hard way, right, is getting our own health insurance. It's extraordinarily expensive and it's sticker shock for people because they think their health insurance costs X, you know, a couple hundred bucks a month, but your employer is subsidizing part of that. So again, it's just kind of rules of the game. But actually what got me into this was the tax brackets, right? So we have a progressive tax system where there are marginal brackets where if you earn over X, if your taxable income is over X, then that next dollar, the marginal dollar, gets taxed at a different rate. Okay. So that doesn't mean that all of your dollars, let's say, for instance, I'm looking at married filing joint right now for 2021. So the first one is the 10% tax bracket. So that's taxable income up to $19,750. Is taxed at 10%, okay? And then that next dollar is taxed at 12%, all right? The $19,751st dollar up to $80,250. Now, that doesn't mean, and this is critical, because again, rules of the game. If you make $19,751, it doesn't mean every single one of those dollars is taxed at 12%, right? It doesn't work that way. You don't go over that cliff of that $1 and then you get screwed, right? Like every dollar prior gets taxed at a higher rate. It doesn't work that way. It's those first $19,750 are taxed at 10%. Then the next set of dollars up to $80,250 is taxed at 12%. And then that next dollar, the marginal dollar, is 22%. So this is the single most important thing you can know about our tax system is that it is a progressive tax system with marginal brackets. Okay. And Jonathan, right? Like, I mean, I would say 75% of people don't know that minimum off the top of their head. And it's critical to inform so many other things, right? Like, what do you contribute to a 401k, right? All these things. Hey, should I put money in my HSA to get myself down below a threshold? Or what percentage am I paying? Like, all of these things are critical. And most normal citizens, we just don't know it.
Hey, this is Andrew from the ChooseFI team. Hope you're enjoying the show. We're going to get right back to it after these quick messages.
When you were highlighting the HSA there, it struck me that we're talking about going to the employer to find out if they have access to a 401k. Really, you should look at all the benefits that your employer, if you have one, actually offers. Like, there's two more that come to mind. Employers will often, especially in S&P 500 type companies, which obviously by definition employ most people here in the United States. That actually may not be true. I actually heard the majority of people are employed by small businesses, but my idea of many people are employed by S&P 500 businesses. But where I was going with that, a lot of them have employee stock purchase plans. These are extra benefits that you potentially have. Your employer will incentivize you by offering you a substantial discount on, you know, buying the stock of your employer. And there is some holding period that you have to hold it. But, you know, in exchange for that, then after that period's over, you can do whatever you want. They're subsidizing it. They're giving you extra money to do this. Now, would I personally want to own anything extra I could inside of one of these? No, but would I make a calculated bet? They're discounting this. I'm going to get it at this discounted price. I'm going to hold it for the term. A lot of people, and then I'm going to sell it on the other side. A lot of people make that decision and are able, I mean, it's worth anywhere from, you know, $1,000 to $5,000 extra a year for people that ended up, you know, looking into that. Let's add on to that. Another benefit is, you know, you mentioned that the HSA, just in passing there, a lot of employers, if you get a plan that has an HSA attached, they will also add extra money to your HSA on your behalf. So it's just, I've seen this many, many times. These are ways that we can maximize what we're getting inside of our salary. And these are things that they're going to work inside the tax code. We'll come outside of the tax code in a second here when we're talking about rules of the game. But for this first pass, we'll stick with just, you know, rules of the game inside the tax code. And those are the two that came to mind.
Yeah. And Jonathan, even just something that, you know, if we're talking just super high level, right? I said the marginal brackets are the most important thing. And I would add on to that and say, just even understanding the difference between a tax deduction and a tax credit. You talk about rules of the game. You always hear people throwing around the term, oh, I'm going to write it off, or, oh, they just wrote it off.
I know it drives you crazy if people say, I say write it off. Come on. It's a reasonable term to use.
It's a reasonable term, but most people hear that and they think, oh, it's free. It was just written off, right? Like, I mean, isn't that fair to say, like, some people hearing that say, oh, that means it was free.
Yes, 100%. Right. And they definitely, even if they don't mean that, by saying they write it off, they 100% conflate deduction and credit.
Right, exactly. And yeah, I think a lot of people say that like in a derisive way of, oh, that company got away with something. They just wrote off that expense of that car or something as if it were free. And, you know, it's just, again, it's important to just understand how the world works. When someone writes something off, which is just called a tax deduction, it just means that was a legitimate business expense. Whether you agree with the business expense or not is none of your business ultimately, but it's a legitimate business expense. And that was taken, so you have your income. And this is how a deduction works on your own individual return, right? Not just a business return, but it's the same concept. You have your gross income, right? Your sales, your whatever. And any expenses, like let's say you owned a rental home. Any legitimate expenses to, let's say, a repair, you get to deduct that. So you don't just report all of your gross rent and you don't get to deduct the management fees, the, hey, we needed to repair a ceiling fan or something. Like, no, of course, those are deductions. But again, to derisively say, oh, it's just a write-off, it's not free. It's just a percentage of it, right? Because again, it's the intersection of that marginal bracket. Right, Jonathan? Because, you know, if it flows through to your individual return and you're in a 12% bracket, well, that deduction was worth 12% to you. So that's a tax deduction, whereas a tax credit is a dollar for dollar. That is truly the write-off that most people think, right? A tax credit is a dollar for dollar reduction in the liability, the tax liability. So let's say you go through on your regular 1040, you have all your income, you have all your deductions, you get down to your taxable income, and then you apply the tax brackets. And now naturally your whatever, you know, TurboTax or whatever does this for you. You're not sitting there with a pen and paper, but you get your tax liability. And then let's say you got the child tax credit. Well, that is a dollar for dollar reduction in that liability. Okay. So that is a 100%. There's 100% value of a tax credit as opposed to a tax deduction is just worth whatever marginal bracket you're in. So hopefully that made sense out there.
Yeah. So for instance, like in the tax credit scenario with the child tax credit, let's say you're in a 22% marginal tax bracket, you know, and you've earned $10,000 at that marginal tax bracket, which has created a $2,200 tax bill on that extra $10,000 that you earned. A child tax credit of $2,000 would wipe out $2,000 of that, right? Yep. As opposed to a deduction would only take out a percentage of, you know, whatever amount was actually being affected. So tax credit, wildly preferable, but it doesn't. And this is a big point. Brad is always trying to talk me down to the sledge because I think a lot of us, and I'm so susceptible to this, will chase those tax credits. We will chase them, right? And I think most of us understand that having six kids to get six tax credits is a very, very dumb thing. But when you find out that there is a solar tax credit, then it's a whatever it is now, 22, 26%. It's like, wow. And I honestly, Brad, you ended up going for it at one point. You got that tax credit. I did the same math this year. And honestly, it was an article that Brian Feraldi, who wrote it at Choose FI, put together for us. You can just Google Choose FI, are solar panels worth the investment? Or it'll be linked up in the show notes for this episode. He put it together. It was Brad talking me down off chasing the tax credit ledge combined with the actual math. Like, even if you got the tax credit, what would this cost you? Taking a look at the actual ROI after the tax credit was involved allowed me to say, even with that, do the numbers still make sense? And my point, I could actually walk you through that math. But basically, TLDR in my scenario with the quote, the original quote that I got, it would take me about 16 to 20 years to recoup what I was going to spend on these solar panels if everything went perfect. And nothing is ever perfect. And, you know, that would also imply that you're going to be staying in the same house. And this is all after the tax credit is accounted for. And I just realized, again, based on this article and Brad, you know, it's not worth it necessarily just by itself. Just because you're getting a tax credit doesn't necessarily, like, it would be more without the credit. Okay, well, it doesn't mean that this is still a good decision for you at this time just because you're getting it. And so it's just kind of like, you still got to do the math. Tax credits are always better than deductions, but you still got to do the math.
Yeah. And I think that's really, really important. And how you laid that out is perfect. What I always like to say is don't let the tax tail wag the dog. So many of us just reflexively like don't want to pay taxes. And, you know, I understand that from a perspective.
I would rather spend $40,000 on solar than send the government, you know, $8,000, like whatever that number was. Like, man, look at me winning. That's the tax tail wagging the dog.
Exactly. Right. Or I think what a lot of people do, I remember my parents saying this growing up, like, oh, we have to have a mortgage so we can get the tax deduction. Right. And it's like, okay, if you're especially like if you're in the 12% tax bracket, that means you're paying $1 in interest to some Globo bank to get 12 cents back from the government. That's really what we're talking about here. So I think that's like the case study of don't let the tax tail wag the dog.
Wow. That really brought home, because now you've got one example for tax credits and one, you know, for home, and all of us are guilty. I mean, I've been guilty of, you know, oh man, just get a bigger mortgage and then you get more of a deduction. Like, come on. Come on, dude. You're smarter than this. No, I'm not. It feels so right.
It does feel right. And but again, it's knowing the rules of the game, right? Like as you said, like with the solar, I mean, that's how you should consider it, but you shouldn't make the decision just solely because of it. It would be silly to not consider it, right? Like when I was looking at it, I got a 30% credit. So that means the government gave me 30% of what I laid out completely for free. So that has to factor into the economic analysis of does this make sense?
Honestly, I'm not putting solar to the side, just the quote I got. That just didn't work. Like, I mean, these are really critical. So like now it's going back to the drawing board and I've got a lot, Brad, you said you got to get some more quotes. I got some more quotes and I was like, wow, that's a really expensive quote that I got the first time around. Let me try again. But again, it's math. You got to just understand, you got to put the math together. This is a great article. For those of you that are still looking at solar, there is savings here and that tax credit is substantial, but definitely this is the best article that I've seen on putting together. Brian did a wonderful job laying it out. And while not everything that he talks about is going to be applicable to you, he lives in Rhode Island. There were some, you know, very specific grants that were available at the time. And the tax credit, like Brad said, was a little bit higher at the time. It doesn't mean that it might not work for you. It's just do the math first.
Yeah. Jonathan, you mentioned Brian. He has been on our podcast, what, 4 or 5 times at this point. He's one of our absolute favorite guests. And I actively follow him on Twitter. He has just an amazing, amazing Twitter account. I think he's up over about 200,000 Twitter followers, and he just adds value constantly. Mm. And talking about adding value, we actually are thrilled to say that he has a book coming out that we're helping publish with Chooseify Publishing, and it's called Why Does the Stock Market Go Up? So yeah, this is super cool. I'm actually looking at an early draft of it right now. And yeah, I'm super, super excited. So yeah, we'll keep everybody updated, obviously. But yeah, Jonathan, this is pretty cool.
And everyone listening, that book, Why Does the Stock Market Go Up? If you're interested in getting more information on that, it's really indicated to be, you know, a primer to really break down, you know, Wall Street into the simple mechanics that actually go into it. So the basics of investing, learn how the financial system currently works and how that should inform your decisions and allow you to use that information to make, you know, decisions about retirement savings and investments. The last time Brian was on our show, we actually talked about specifically how to evaluate and analyze a stock and, you know, come up with the different metrics that you should be looking at to evaluate the health of the stock. It's just kind of stock fundamentals. And he gave us a copy of his worksheet. It's been, if you check out his Twitter channel, this is a worksheet that's been hugely popular with the people that have followed what he's done. He gave us a copy and you can access that for free if you want to go to chooseify.com/Brian. That's B-R-I-A-N, chooseify.com/Brian. You can download that checklist and you'll also get more information about the book when that becomes available. And that checklist is literally the exact checklist that he uses every month to evaluate individual stocks. So Brad, that was, you know, if you talk about earn more, we address that. And certainly there's going to be spillover as we talk about the tax code with each one of these pieces of this FI equation. But when it comes to saving money, there is a way to save money in a tax optimized way. And there's a way to, when you have to make purchases, make those purchases in a way that are tax optimized. So save money. We talked a little bit about this in terms of earn more. Are you taking advantage of your employer's 401k and are they offering you a match? But you need to understand that when you save money in your bank account and you could be saving money inside of your 401k, that decision is costing you. It's costing you money. You're having to pay the government your marginal tax rate to then bring some amount home. So if you had $100 and you wanted to save that in your checking account, it might look a lot like $80, might look a lot like $70, just depending on your marginal tax rate and your state taxes, right? If you make the choice to save that inside of your 401k or in your retirement choices, you keep all of that and that will then grow tax-free. And then at some point when you pull it out, when you're making that decision to, you will then pay your tax rate at that particular. This is a fundamental point. It's got to be hit a couple different ways. And that would affect, you know, how are you saving for retirement? But there's also, all of us have to make purchases. And for those of us, especially that are business owners or have a small business or have a, you know, a side hustle, we have to make expenses. And, you know, Brad, you were talking about this earlier about organizing those expenses. You rightly have the ability when you're making a business expense, that is a cost of doing business. That's not profit. That's a cost of doing business. And so you can deduct that as a business expense. And there's a full-on list, but accountants have this list. So if it's something that is a cost to you to operate and run your business, a legitimate business expense, and depending on your type of business, that could be traveling to a conference, that could be the conference ticket because it's a networking event, it could be equipment that you need to operate your business, it could be, you know, the place that you actually do business. So your actual real estate location, your geographic location, it could be your home office in many cases. It could be wages paid out to individuals. It is to your benefit, rightly so, to say, this is not profit. This is not income. This is an expense. So any income that I make, any revenue that I make, gross revenue, you need to deduct these expenses. This is just common. It makes sense to some people, but a lot of people don't do it when they're running a business casually or they haven't gotten there yet. Or if they do do it, they don't document it. And I'll give this back to Brad because there's a very simple way that you can describe this. They don't document. Documentation is everything. And it doesn't require fancy software. It quite literally just requires documentation.
Yeah, you're right. And I think, yeah, for so many people, I suspect they actually are over-reporting their business income because they don't realize, oh, wow, I can actually deduct a lot of these things that are truly a part of my business. And that, I mean, that's the key, right? Is clearly these have to be legitimate business expenses, but those can be deducted off of the income that you earn. It's just the way it goes. So very, very simple. Like you can do a lot of documenting methods, but I mean, Jonathan, for the first couple years of Choose FI, you know that I literally have printouts. I mean, this is like, you know, dinosaur level stuff. But this worked for me is I quite literally printed out every single expense and I had them numbered. So if we ever got audited, the auditor would come in, I would hand him or her this stack of 200 or 300 pieces of paper that are all numbered. I would show them the Excel document that showed all of our income and all of our expenses, and they would go on their merry way, right? Because like that is perfect documentation, even though it's, like I said, dinosaur level stuff. You can make PDFs, obviously. You can do as little or as much as you want, but I would highly advise just making sure you have as many of the invoices or emails or whatever it may be. Like you said, you might sign up, like in the case of an online business, you might sign up for hosting, right? Like you need hosting for your website, even if it's $7 a month. Well, you get that invoice every month, just save that in a certain folder or print it as a PDF and save it to Google Drive. I just have a folder for 2021 receipts and I just name that file, the date and the amount and who it was paid to. So like, that's not hard, but it's really annoying if you waited at the end of the year or a couple years later, if you got audited and you have to then go back and recreate it as opposed to, okay, I just did it right from the outset. So I think that's just a really, really easy way to just look at, okay, my business expenses. But I think it's not just limited to that. I don't want to clearly limit this to just people who have businesses. Like I do this for my own personal tax return is at this point, it's just as I go along. So if we make a charitable contribution or if I pay some type of, let's say, real estate tax or something, like anything that would be deductible, I just simply scan it or take a photo and save it in that same folder that I have for my own personal tax return. And I just keep one Excel document. So at the end of the year, I send that Excel doc over to my CPA, who I actually have do my own return, who may or may not be Laura, but no, it previously was Laura, but now I actually do pay a CPA to do that and send over that one doc and then send the PDFs as well. And that's it. It's all just organized. So I think that's my big takeaway is just organization, if you can. It doesn't have to be a big imposition. It's more of an imposition when you don't do it and then you have to scramble. I think that's, it's so important that we know this. Like, it's like that discipline equals freedom, Jonathan, that quote from Jocko Willing that we've mentioned so many times here. Like, this is an example of discipline equals freedom. Sure, it takes a tiny little bit of discipline to do this right every single time. But man, it gives you the freedom to know I am 100% spot on because I've done it right all the time, just as I see them. So, I mean, to me, that is a lot more freeing mentally.
And I think that for those of you that do have small businesses or side hustles that are bringing in revenue, or even really just getting started, you know, having that partition there, especially for those of you that are doing forensics afterwards, trying to organize, you'll realize very quickly it's not fun to try to separate your personal expenses from your business expenses. So having that partition there, but also realizing that when you're actually paying for these rules of the game, there's ways to optimize all of these expenses, many of them. Travel rewards. Let's talk about travel rewards for just a second. Travel rewards are a loophole in the tax code, from my perspective. It is a way that you can get tax-free additional income. When you put your personal expenses on a credit card and you pay an 18% interest rate to carry the minimum balance, you're losing the game. Like, so talking about rules, you're losing the game. That's not what I'm talking about. But when you use a credit card and you get either cash back, or if you want to scale it up even further, you get travel rewards, that is not considered taxable income. Travel rewards in particular, if you're really to optimize this, and Brad can point you to particular episodes for those of you that want to go a little bit farther and learn about this, you can stagger and open a series of high value travel rewards credit cards that have an estimated value of $500 to $1,000 in many cases that you can use towards travel of your choice. And what you can do is, while normally this would have been an expense that you would have to, you know, purchase these tickets or hotels or rental cars, in many cases, you'd have to pay for them all with post-tax dollars, you can actually use this extra additional income that is non-taxable. And it's just an incredible, incredible optimization tactic that we've staggered in there. And you can also do that for business expenses as well. And I can tell you that there are many, 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 many business owners. Somehow I haven't figured out how to be one of them yet. I don't know why that is. Maybe at some point we'll get it all worked out. But there are many business owners. They have to run advertising for their business. Advertising is one of the lifelines for their business. They have a business. They need to advertise for their business. They're running maybe a business that has a high profit margin. And so, you know, maybe they spend, and I mean, quite literally, $100,000 a month, $50,000 a month, $10,000 a month, $1 million a month, not unheard of. But maybe that $1 million a month generates $2 million worth of revenue. I don't know. Make up the numbers. The point is, they're not doing this and losing money, right? They pay some amount in ads But in theory, if you're not doing this, again, you're losing the game. You have not paid attention to the rules. Rule number one, don't lose money. Rule number two, make sure you respect rule number one. But in the scenario where you are spending $25,000 a year on advertising revenue and you're generating, you know, $26,000 in revenue, $50,000 in revenue, even if it were just 25 and 25, which again, you know, you spend 25 and you make 25. While I probably wouldn't personally do that, I would just say if they were doing it using a rewards card, they would generate 25, you know, whatever the redemption is for that number of spend. Spend money, you make rewards. I know a lot of people that are doing way, way better than that. In fact, they fly for free year round. They pay for their family to fly for free year round. They, you know, they never spend money on travel again. And they're probably flying first class in some of these cases. That's just for those of you that are business owners and need to pay for things and are making the choice to pay via credit card, there is something to consider. There's a way to optimize that. But it also works for those of you that don't have a business, in that you can take your personal spend and you can optimize around sign-up bonuses and optimize around redemptions. And you can still likely travel, at least you personally, for free. And for many of you, you could travel your whole family for free, you know, for 1 to 2 trips a year, Brad.
Yeah, you're right. Obviously, I've been doing this for many, many years. Yeah, we have a whole set of resources at chooseify.com/travel. And yeah, like you're saying, I mean, that's just a wonderful way.
I got a little rambunctious with the whole $1 million a month thing, but the point remains.
Yeah, the point holds. The point certainly holds. For most of us, if we are going to have responsible credit habits, which to me means paying it off on time and in full every single month, if you can do that and get no rewards, or you can do that and put your spending on very specific targeted credit cards that earn you large signup bonuses that can be worth, like you said, $1,000 per credit card signup. Well, that seems like a win. And I know you and I have both taken our families on trips around the world using rewards points. So again, it's just knowing the rules of the game. So many of these things seem complicated to people when they first hear about it, but it's like anything. It's step by step. You have to just learn about these things step by step. And, you know, Jonathan, we talk about just like overarching principles of financial independence. And I mean, we've talked so many times about, hey, what are like the massive wins that you could potentially have by living a FI life, which is, hey, we're keeping our expenses low. We're saving a boatload of money. We're reaching a point of financial independence. And we may stop working at some point. We may not be bringing in additional income. Well, I mean, then you get into a situation where, and I mean, we've talked about these big three, and regardless of how we feel personally about these things, it doesn't matter. It's just knowing the rules of the game. We've said, okay, there's a conceivable world where you can get your health insurance for virtually free because you qualify for subsidies, significant subsidies under the ACA. You could potentially be in a scenario where your kids can go to college for virtually nothing because your income is minimal, right? We're talking about somebody who's at FI. And again, I'm not talking about the ethics of this. It's not relevant what I think about it and whether I agree or not. It's what are the rules? So there are many colleges that look at your income, not your assets necessarily, but your income over what do you have to pay? So, okay, that's a scenario where someone who's FI could benefit, right? We talked many, many times, Jonathan, about, again, tax optimization, but in a different sense of what if you have all of your money in tax-deferred vehicles like 401ks and the like, and you're earning $0. You can pull money out of those 401ks through things like the Roth IRA conversion ladder, or even if you're, let's say you're over 59 and a half and you can just do this normally. Well, if you're earning $0 of income and your life only costs $40,000 a year, well, you can pull that $40,000 out of your 401k and that's all of your taxable income, right? And then you get your deductions. You get your standard deduction. You get maybe some credits. You're probably in a scenario where you're paying $0 of federal tax. So again, these are these massive potential wins, but it all just comes down to, do I understand the rules?
I have no problem saying ethically, you should do whatever you can to spend as little on college and really as little on healthcare, personally. I mean, I don't know. Shower thoughts, controversial thoughts. I don't know. I feel good about it. I sleep like a baby. It's probably due to that cold thermal blanket I'm about to order, just thinking about it.
Nice.
Like if you spend $100,000 on your local state college in 2021, oh man. You know, I think that's one of our rules of the game. Like, what are the rules for our kids? We can't let our kids take out $100,000 in student loan debt for a degree that pays $50,000 a year. You know, we can't afford the minimum payments on our credit cards over our lifetime. We can't afford, you know, managing the car payments over your lifetime. These are just massive ways when it comes to saving money. Like, buy a great car, drive it forever. You know, buy a great car, drive it forever. Don't be switching it out every 5 years, always managing the payments. That decision's going to cost you $750,000 over your lifetime. How do we calculate that? We've done it a couple of times. We can go listen to episode 22 of our podcast for more information. ChooseAFI.com/022. College, I mean, do I really need to like go there? You guys know, like at this point, I feel like you should have been at least slightly indoctrinated to like just be reviled by the thought of spending $100,000 on college without having a clear plan that doesn't involve making, I don't know, $200,000 on the other side. That's what you need to make to justify $100,000 in tuition, in my mind. If you don't have a guaranteed job making at least $200,000, what are you doing? And I say this because most people are graduating. Average student loan debt is well past $50,000 at this point, going to $100,000. If you graduate with $100,000 in student loan debt and you're making $50,000 a year, and you're not quickly on ramping your way up past 200,000. And I'm adding tiny little caveats just to be generous. I'm saying if you don't make 200,000 out the gate, that's how, just because there's all their alternatives. There's so many other alternatives that don't involve that 4 years that you're in school and all that. All right. I get it. Soapbox moving on. But there's more. You can optimize around, you know, Brad, you mentioned the subsidies, understanding where those subsidy cliffs are, where the tax code optimizes for certain decision trees, how to plan going into that, optimizing around charitable contributions, understanding how those of you that are making large charitable contributions can optimize around donor advised funds. We'll have a link to an article that'll walk you through that. So these are all things that we're doing. There's ways to save money even on those. We get to the other side of the equation. We're talking about investing now. How do these investments, how do they interact with the tax code? How does real estate and real estate deductions interact with the tax code? How can we move from one property to another without incurring, you know, a massive taxable event? What are the capital gains exclusions for selling your primary home? How does that affect the decision that we make? Capital gains taxes, short-term capital gains and long-term capital gains on securities. We talked about that. That was episode 346. How do I figure out the tax on that? Chooseify.com/346. How can you bring all of this together to create, you know, a well-rounded retirement account? Think about that. In this episode, did we answer all of these definitively? Clearly not. But if you take, all right, these are the rules of the game. I'm listening to this episode. I need to go deeper on each one of those. Have we pointed you? You're not going to solve them all right away. But you're going to start working on one piece and the other. You're going to immerse yourself in these. And I promise you, when I was doing episode 4 or 5 of the podcast, I didn't feel that confident about all of these. You know, it's hundreds of episodes later where we've come at them and we've, you know, readdressed them and we had new input and we've been able to kind of narrow the lens or focus the lens. You get much more confident about how these are going to play with each other and play nicely. And you can make a phenomenal plan for yourself regardless of what life throws at you. Rules of the game, Brad. Final thoughts.
No, I think you just hit it right there. You're not going to learn all of this at once, but it's just, like you said, it's layering on this information and you're expanding that zone of awareness. Like you just said, sometimes you can defer taxes on rental real estate. Like, oh, I heard somebody talk about a 1031 exchange. Maybe I should go research that. You're not going to get that from 1 hour long podcast, but now you have the idea that that's possible. Oh, capital gains exclusion on my primary residence sale. Oh, I wonder what that means. And then you look it up and you say, oh, wow. You mean if my house goes up, if I'm single, my house goes up $249,000 when I sell it, I pay nothing in capital gains tax? Or if I'm married, it's a $500,000 exclusion? Oh, that's pretty cool. That zone of awareness, it expands and expands and expands. And you learn the rules. And then this stuff is not that complicated anymore. It's just little pieces of information. Like you said, Jonathan, you've learned most of this over the last 5 years. And that's just how it works. You learn new stuff. You're interested. You just keep expanding. So yeah, I think it's fun. Like I love learning new things.
It is fun. And for those of you that aren't getting started, we've put together a Pathfinder series for you to really just help you choose your own adventure. To check that out, go to chooseify.com/start. All right, my friends, the fire is spreading. We'll see you next time as we continue to go down the road less traveled.